everybody, and welcome back to You Can't Win. This is Tom here, and I'm joined by Donald as usual, and we're joined once again by fan favorite Leopold. We're going to be talking today about how to look good, how to dress good. Is that important? Is that not important? Then we'll probably be fielding some questions after that. So Leo is kind of like the expert on fashion in the room here. Donald and I are probably not that at all. So why don't you start us off, Leo, and tell us how you feel about that? And maybe if you do think it's important to look good, maybe give us the argument for that.
First of all, it's beautiful to be again on this wonderful podcast. And let me tell you, dressing well, it's not just for the learned upper classes of Louis Napoleon's France in 1870s. Let me tell you, what dressing well does is it hides your flaws, it emphasizes your skull, and then on top of that, it makes your eyes pop out of your head. And when you're doing that, you don't have to worry about anything, because once your eyes are floating in somebody's head, they're going to listen to what you say. Have to say, you're not going to take guff from them. If they give you guff, they're going to cower. They're going to shrink. They're going to shrink like a snail into a shell. And past that, you got to say, you just have to support the hardworking artisans which make our sumptuous garments.
That makes sense. Yeah, you're always supporting the tailors and the people that make our clothes. I appreciate that. That's
you've heard my theory about reviving the economy by teaching people how to tailor clothes and having people submit their own clothing designs to be made immediately by local artisans who are built on local textile industries. Just that sort of thing that we could do if we had a different economic model. And that would be easy as pie.
Yeah, it's funny because the typical economic argument is you just try to get rid of those jobs as much as possible. You just try to get them to be the cheapest labor in the cheapest countries, get it far away from you or I, and kind of just, you know. So I don't know. I mean, I like the idea of like a small producer's kind of, yeah, like a flourishing of that. I don't know. It's a nice idea. I just think that, yeah, I don't know. It's funny because like who's the candidate right now, or who's the... Is there the faction for that yet? You know, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're pretty far from it. But when you see this anti-monopoly stuff, once you break up large consolidated enterprises, you get a little bit closer to a world where small producers can make a living and they don't, you know, they don't have to be subsumed into something else. I don't know if it's realistic, but I mean, at this point, it's realistic for people who like strange bondage clothing, fursuits, and the ultra rich, you know, buying, you know, couture.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly would be nice for people just to look a little better than wearing, like, you know,
Kmart no offense box shirts and stuff. To my friends in the Kingdom of Siam, but everybody in America looks like a Thai street vendor now, and it's really sad with, you know, plastic shoes, a very loose tunic, sort of a shirt, and then the cut off pants. it's rough out there, and you look, it's not really their fault, because you go to the store, let's say you go to Macy's in like a normal price level department store, and it's just all bad. There's nothing good.
Yeah, I don't know. And like, what do you think about athleisure in that kind of trend?
Athleisure is really great for companies that make athleisure, because they can use non-organic fabrics. They can use petroleum to make fabrics at a fixed cost, and they can glue that stuff together. You only need one pass on a sewing machine if you have any segments of the garment at all, if it's not all just glued together. So you can really crank it out. Under Armour's profit margin has been 88% for as long as they've existed. It is easy to make athleisure, and they charge like it's a premium, but it's great for them. It's terrible for us, because polyester fabrics like to trap bacteria that cause very stinky underarm sweat. So I would say athleisure, once we take power, it's gone, no more.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things for me, I guess, is just that I've always, I guess for the last 10 years or so, it's always been a deferral in my mind for two reasons. One, just because I gained a bunch of weight, and then two, because I didn't have much money or anything, right? So I was kind of like, oh, I won't even like think about dressing now kind of thing or anything like that, right? I'll just leave that to the future when I lose weight and stuff. And then I realized that like that was actually causing me a lot of anxiety about just getting dressed in the morning and all that kind of stuff, just weird things about that kind of thing, you know, like just it was like causing, you know, like a fret about it or something, like what yeah. should I wear, what stuff like that. And it's funny because of OCD and stuff, I just kind of, I ended up creating almost like a uniform for myself that I just wear every day when I'm at home, basically, like just the same basic kind of thing. And I think that's like a, it's not really, it's one of those things where it's like a stopgap kind of solution, but I do want to, you know, in the future, I don't know, because I dress generally when I go out and stuff like I'm a teenager or something like that kind of thing, right? Like I've got the Jay's hat and all that kind of stuff, right? And I don't know. I think that that's something I'll have to transition away from as I almost turn 40 soon. So turn 39 in a few months. So, yeah.
I don't know, but yeah. that's kind of like what a normal outfit would be these days. I mean,
yeah,
that's good or bad, but I don't think that's unusual, really.
Yeah, but I mean, that's what, you know, Leo was saying, that it might be good to move away from that in general.
Right.
As a confidence thing and all that.
Yeah, I mean, if your wardrobe is something you've chosen based on your, like, let's say you have some idea of yourself and some idea of your place in the world, it makes more sense to buy clothing that suits that than to just rest in comfort every day. And I mean, everybody knows, like, if you're in a nicely tailored suit and you're just walking around town, you just feel better. You feel stronger. You feel like you're more, you feel like you're higher in the social hierarchy because you just look good. It's hard to beat.
Yeah. I mean, I've never felt comfortable in suits, though. Like, I want the kind of like the outfit you were describing, like the Thai street vendor stuff, like that. That's comfortable to me. So that's I don't know. I feel good wearing that kind of stuff.
Like mentally comfortable or physically comfortable?
Kind of. I mean, it's mainly physical comfort, but because that's like I feel physically comfortable, then I'm just happy, and then I feel mentally comfortable. When I'm wearing, I kind of feel like, you know that Smog song, XCon?
Mm-hmm.
I kind of feel like that when I'm wearing clothes that cost more than like $20. You know what I mean?
Jean jacket and tie. Feels like
such a lie. Yeah.
Tom, I don't think you're any kind of robot by any kind of river. It's just a matter of finding clothes that are cut for you with the right textiles so you don't feel uncomfortable wearing them. It's mm-hmm. it's trickier than it should be just because there's so much crap in every store, and you almost have to become a hobbyist to discover what's good and what's bad and what's a trick and what's just a nice garment made by healthy red-cheeked artisans waiting for you.
Yeah, and I can't really be bothered to do that. I mean, if I had a little bit of more like disposable income, maybe I'd be more interested in that kind of thing. But I kind of just find stuff that I feel like it looks fine on me. You know, I try to pick colors that are appropriate for my tone or whatever. And I don't know. I'm happy the way I look and I feel comfortable. So it's not like an amazing, striking look that I have or anything, but I'm fine with it. I don't know.
Speaking of colors, it used to be that in say a department store or any kind of clothing store, you'd go in and the salesman would identify your colors, like obviously you're finished, so it's like red and yellow, and they'd set you out your blue tones and your whites and grays that would make you look your best, that would make your colors not look sallow and sickly. Mm-hmm. And that would clothes that would just basically draw an arrow pointing to your face. And that went away with the rise of sort of the mall chain store where they just pack things in on a rack and you don't have an experienced salesperson. You just have your average retail employee. That's what's really the culprit of everybody looking terrible, because it went from personalized looks, maybe based on the trend of the time, to it just being a big pile of whatever is decided to be on trend and you're supposed to sort through it yourself.
Do you think that was true for people from like all kinds of positions in society, upper class and lower class and all that, everything in between?
Well, I mean, I don't know how lower class you want to go, but you can look at old photos and see people who we define as poor, and they look natty compared to say some lawyer today who can afford a nice suit. They look like they're in the Brooks Brothers' worst nightmare.
It's always their haircuts. Their haircuts are always just dog shit, you know.
They like to have a weirdly feathered flat thing that lawyers do. Yeah. What's behind the lawyer's haircut?
Sometimes you see guys, it looks like they had some kind of weird bowl cut thing. It's like it's just like bangs down, like soggy bangs in the front or something. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like a mop kind of a haircut.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's like they have a receding hairline, but they want to show as much. They want to cover as much scalp as they can without it being a comb over. So they do that odd bang drift. It makes them look like a kid on picture day.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I guess that's one thing is you don't, there's something about being a little bit like not try hardy about your looks that kind of makes everything work a little bit better than if you're doing something like that. Like if you're putting in a lot of effort to cover up some kind of insecurity that it doesn't seem natural, then that makes you look worse, even if you are wearing like really, really nice clothes or whatever, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's like the Jersey Shore thing or like any kind of gangster suit sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And now you have really terrible. If you go back to the 70s, Cartier, they sort of innovated the business model of making incredibly tacky clothes by anybody's description for the nouveau riche. And that's just what all of contemporary fashion has become. It's all like $350 slides that, you know, with the Gucci logo and mm-hmm. a pair of sweatpants with a gold embroidered thread that costs $1,700. It's not about let me state it like this. Albert Elbaz, who's a famous designer, incredible designer, worked for Lanvin for years, was just known as one of the best. And he retired from fashion and he wrote this letter and basically said that in the 1960s, 1970s, the 1980s, if a woman wanted to look beautiful, she would get a beautiful ball gown, you know, cut for her figure. But now if a woman wants to look beautiful, she goes and gets breast implants, she gets a facelift, she gets filler, she gets, you know, the body itself is worked on instead of, there's no clothing intermediary. The clothing just happens to be like a tight wrapper to showcase the plastic surgery.
That's interesting.
I feel like a lot of the contemporary men's clothing, it's not meant to look good unless you're a full-time CrossFit bodybuilder or whatever.
Yeah.
I think if you're not that, then you just get like a big bag that hangs over your body, like a sheet ghost.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that feel. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the concerns I always have is that I'm like, if I spend more on clothes and stuff, is it like, it seems like that's like the 10th ranked problem there kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? Like in terms of improving appearance and stuff, it's like, if I spent all on that, then why wouldn't I do all the other steps ahead of that kind of thing? You know what I mean? Like there's only so much that's going to improve. But I mean, as you said, it's like a cycle, because if you don't take that part seriously, then you're never going to get everything else and, you know, all your other ducks in line, I guess.
So, well, don't get breast implants, Donald. I've been telling you. That's not...
Breast implant illness. Look it up. It's killing women. Don't buy Allergan stock. If you have it, sell it. They're going down in gigantic class action lawsuits that are being put together today. That's insider info from me to you and to the fans.
Yeah, let's take them down, the fake booby people.
They're killing women. They're killing Cardi B. They're killing everybody. They're killing daytime talk show host Wendy Williams, but she refuses to have hers taken out. And so she keeps having these episodes of erratic behavior, and people think she's an alcoholic or on drugs, but it's just her slowly dying of heavy metal poisoning to keep things light.
Okay.
I believe it, to be honest. That kind of makes sense. She is pretty crazy. You know, there's something I wanted to ask you, Leo. I went shoe shopping recently, and I got some nice shoes that I think should be helping my back. I have flat feet, so I think I needed the arch support in my shoes. I wasn't getting any of that. My feet were just killing me at the end of the day. So now I got nice shoes that are, it feels really comfortable to walk around in. But one thing I noticed was that there's a lot of shoes that, and I've noticed this for a while, but it seems like it's the default thing now to just have tons of crazy colors on like your sneakers and stuff. And it just looks really bad to me. And I can't tell if it's me and I don't get what's happening with the shoes or what that's about. I just don't understand. Like, to me, like a decent looking shoe is a little bit more muted. Like it's just kind of a single color or a particular palette and not like bright green and blue shoelaces and like red soles. And you know what I'm talking about? Like, is this like an Instagram?
I know exactly something? What you're talking about. It's the whole sneaker culture thing. I mean, you could call it infantilization. You could call it heavy branding and marketing. Like your colorful shoe itself is a brand. And so you can ignore the fact that it's just made of the cheapest leather glued together, you know, in some Bangladeshi factory. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't look good. I mean, if you're a super cool guy and you're like 21, you can wear some colorful sneakers. But if you're 30 years old and you're wearing colorful sneakers out on the town, you just look like a jabroni, as The Rock would say.
Yeah,
there's just nothing. I mean, sneaker culture is just a thing to itself. It doesn't actually look good by any objective measurement.
Yeah, it's just a weird direction that things have gone, and it was making me wonder, like, if things are designed so, because you've mentioned this kind of thing before, that a lot of people are adjusting their looks for Instagram, you know, and it doesn't look good in real life, but it looks catchy on Instagram.
Yeah.
And I wonder
you
if that's
can definitely
what's going on with the
post
shoes.
A colorful shoe on Instagram and get some hearts and some comments with the fire emoji.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. I don't know.
Oh, about flat feet, I can actually help you. There's a great book called 8 Steps to a Pain-Free Back, and it uses a sort of pseudo-anthropological approach to show you about how posture works and how you can improve your posture and your gait. And there are these specific exercises you can do. I did them. I had flat feet. I had to wear orthotics and everything from the foot doctor. Mm-hmm. But I did these exercises for a couple of years, and it actually built the muscles in my feet up, and I don't have to wear orthotics anymore. My feet don't pronate like
that.
Oh,
that sounds great. Yeah, I've heard that orthotics are kind of a scam. Like, they don't really work, and they're extremely expensive. And it's just like you pay a few $100 and then it doesn't work. I'm not interested in anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, it holds your foot in the right position in a static way, but once you're moving, it's not going to hold. Mm-hmm. It's not like it's moving with your foot as your foot spreads out and contracts as you put your weight through it. When you're trail running or kicking office chairs over, whatever you like to do.
Right.
Tom, when you were younger, did you have to wear like special shoes and all that? Or
no, I've never had to really do anything different about my feet until recently.
I did because I had flat feet too, and just it was like a lot of pain and stuff walking around in that, like when I was younger. And then, anyways,
I had that too. Flat foot gang, baby, keep it flat like my hat.
Yeah. So, but I don't know. Maybe I should look into that too for some of my stuff. I think I've got a pair of shoes that don't have great support right now. And whenever I walk around for a while, I know there's like five other reasons it could be doing that too, but my back ends up hurting a lot too. So, yeah.
Yeah. If your feet are flat and your shoes are clapped out, it's gonna hit from your knee up through your butt and right into your lower back, and it's gonna hurt.
Yeah, I think that's what I was doing. My sneakers were just completely falling apart, and I was just wearing them because they hadn't absolutely fallen apart. I could still wear them. I was still wearing it. And I think it was just making me put a lot of my weight on my back.
Sure.
Yeah, once the cushiness goes out of those foam rubber soles, you're just back to, you know, the shock absorbers your own soft tissue instead of the shoe.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, and I mean, that's another thing that's a part of dressing well, is, I guess, like posture and stuff like that too, you know?
Oh yeah. Posture, having good posture and will make a stupid outfit look decent and a good outfit look great. It just, you can see it on old Hollywood people. Just, they have their shoulders back. They have their butts tucked in. They have their knees pushing outward. They're not slumped over. They don't look like Emil Hirsch.
Yeah, okay. Well, I don't know. Do you have, I was thinking maybe you have some advice for someone who's kind of starting from absolutely zero and they have no idea where to go, and they're just trying to improve their look a little bit. What would you advise them to do?
I think what you really want to do is find something you can wear that looks dressed up, but while you're being casual. So say you can find some trousers that aren't like khaki slacks, Stain Defender, no iron dockers, and just find like some button up shirts and polo shirts that actually fit your body. And you're on your way. Wear some loafers instead of, like a Nike Hyper Zoom 13. It's not too hard. I do recommend the book Dressing the Man, even if some of the advice is a little bit dated. But actually, Roger Stone is a huge fan of the author. But he explains everything about menswear from A to Z, from the history to the late 90s. And he has these really damning photos of old Hollywood guys next to like Brad Pitt and George Clooney wearing their black suits with a little black button-up shirt and a little nurse lapel in the early 2000s. You can read that and you'll understand the gist of this if you've never really thought about clothing before.
Cool. All right. Well, I guess we'll just dive into questions from here.
Sure.
Okay. Fine. Oh, I'll tell you who had great style. The Sikh Empire, they had these fighters who were kind of like a regular militia, and they would wear a really large triangular turban that kind of drooped, and they'd have those throwing rings on it, and they just like a stack on their hat, and they just take one off, fling it, and their hat would flop a little bit more, take one off, fling it, until finally it was flopped over like a nightcap. And they were shirtless, looked great, looked like wild men, fought the British, died, but they did a great job looking great.
Yeah, that's Big Dave's ancestors, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. Okay.
That son of a bitch.
All right, so I guess this is a great question to start us off for the question section here. It says, how are we styling today, boys? So I suppose I'll kick this off. I am wearing flannel pajama pants right now and I don't know what you call it. It's like a thermal long sleeve shirt. It's brown. Yeah, so I'm comfy. I'm happy.
Yeah, my standard uniform is I've got ankle socks, one of those like sweatpants that like sort of bunch at the ankle, and then Hanes black tee and a fleece sweater. And I don't know. I am toasty all winter because of that. Yeah.
Comfy boys.
Yeah.
I have a, a royal blue trousers on and a German Navy surplus white button up over a very ragged white tee.
All right. All right, Donald, what is the Canadian version of Pizzagate?
Okay. So I would say that the closest that I would say would be in terms of like a public scandal that actually is proven completely real and all that, it would be something like the residential schools, where they were basically like, you know, people have compared them, you know, sometimes to as like a, depending on things, to like Western China and stuff like that. Like, but on a, you know, like what people are afraid of kind of thing, like the most extreme kind of thing, or a, it's just like a colonial school system that, you know, was like a boarding school for indigenous youth. And they, yeah, they were just like factories of abuse and like beating the kids and killing them and stuff. And and it was like standard government policy for like decades and decades. So, and you know, like they protested, but no one cared at all and stuff, you know? So it was very, it's pretty crazy. And, it's only recently become like a national issue in the last, you know, 10 years or so. It really became like a big thing that a lot of people talk about now. And it was just like, you know, it's amazing because it was happening like even in like the 60s and 70s.
Right. It was like they didn't stop until the like 1970, right?
Yeah. And it, you know, it's funny because that's at the exact same time that Canada was being considered like very hip and an upcoming nation and a great place to live and all that kind of stuff. So it's funny how it, it kind of conflicts with the way that Canada thinks of itself. And yeah, it was just a, I don't know, just like a huge, huge thing. And I have to say that like, I think 2/3 of the schools or something like that were run by the Catholic Church too. So it's not like, it's not just a government thing too. So all the different churches took part though. And that was like another thing is a lot of the churches were just like running the schools. Canada's actually a whole education system used to be a lot more explicitly religious, like a lot more than the United States, I guess, in a lot of ways. Like when I went to school, I remember in kindergarten that we had the, we had prayer in school still. And that was because the schools were considered like Protestant schools, basically.
Damn.
And yeah, they had like a parallel Catholic system. And that was not fully funded public system until like 1985 or something. And in Quebec, until recently, the schools were just run by the Catholic Church, like almost directly, most of them. So anyway, it's just very, it's a very strange sort of, Canada is very, in a lot of ways, just like a colony still. Like it really is just like a colony. It's very strange. Like all the historical stuff that we've kind of inherited. And we are just starting to really reckon with a lot of that. So, yeah. Mm. Anyways. But, yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
You know, I think American schools, like if you go back far enough, were also very strongly religious, right? So I wonder if there's just something that Americans went one direction and Canadians just didn't see a reason to leave that behind or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. They might have diverged earlier because we based our we thought a lot about post-revolutionary France, and they had normal public education even back in like the 1860s. So I think the United States, it wasn't that religious once the public education system was established.
Yeah, I think it's actually gone the other direction since the 60s and 70s, where you have a lot more private schools because in the States because desegregation and all that causing
that was organization
or whatever. So
there was an explosion of that in the South just to get around desegregation laws.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. It's sort of strange in some ways because it keeps coming up in Ontario politics and stuff where you can imagine that like a lot of people don't like the idea that Catholics get their own public system and no one else does kind of thing, you know? So that's kind of a strange sort of settlement that's just exists. I don't know. I don't know. I think that it's fine, you know, because like a lot of people do want that, but it is kind of strange considering that you got to think that like, if people had their choice, there'd probably be a lot more schools that just public schools that teach in Chinese or something, you know, or something like that, you know, like, or in other things, you know? Yeah. Like, I mean, that's actually the big sort of protest thing is sex ed kind of stuff, where that became a big issue in the last provincial election because the Liberals were sort of because we had they hadn't really touched the curriculum for over a decade or something. So there was nothing in it about like trans issues or the gay sort of stuff was all really sort of limited and not really up to date at all to, you know, it wasn't catching up with the culture in different ways. So there was a huge protest by a lot of parents in the other direction, right? Saying they wanted to take their kids out of schools. And that became
conservative parents that were not happy with the introductions of that kind of,
And that was like a multi-faith thing too. I think there's a lot of, you know, because there's a lot of obviously conservative immigrant families and stuff too that were really outraged at that. So
I remember a lot of that was a thing in for Muslims for some reason. I think it was actually centered around UK stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So it's funny because it's one of those issues where it's almost 100% of the left here doesn't even question that should be, you know, there's no issue there for them basically, right? So. Mm-hmm. One of those things where they're like, no, just shut down all the Catholic schools and make it so that people learn whatever is the standard sort of woke take on everything at school and stuff. And I don't know, I feel like it's strange because it's like, I don't know.
Yeah, it's a huge blind spot because they don't realize how captive they are to the moment. Like when you read, I can't remember what it's called, but it's like emotionally aware teaching guides. And it's these things written for teachers to teach through, but it's written like it's for a child to read. And just going on about pronouns and different parenting. And I don't know exactly what I'm saying, but for some people, it's easy to flip a switch, like with the next social issue. It's like, okay, I'm for this. It's fine. But a lot of people just kind of hold their whatever they've come up around. They don't really want to switch that. They don't want to change that. And I don't know how important it is to education to constantly switch on social issues, especially since the United States, we've got the No Child Left Behind Act, which turned curriculum much more into like a cram school style curriculum than learning to think about things. That seems like more of an important issue, like to get away from teaching to tests and instead try and teach people how to think, teach them relevant information. I don't know. I don't know too much about it. It's all pretty weird, but we shouldn't just take whatever is said to be the thing of the day at face value. There's always something weird going on.
Yeah, I feel like it's done in a really clumsy kind of way. Like there's a difference between trying to make things more neutral so that people of different like gender identities and all that stuff feel more comfortable. And there's a difference between that and like having every student do a little project about their gender identity or something where it's like that's not an issue for 90% of people. It's probably confusing to like really young kids if you're introducing that to them. I don't know. Yeah. I don't really know how to feel.
It's confusing enough when you're a kid. It seems more like something that you would do on an individual level, but everything's so bureaucratized that it's probably not possible outside of fancy private schools.
There's basically no such thing as an individual level when it comes to that kind of education.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to think through because like the assumption on a lot of the left is just that parents don't really even have any rights or exist really in any real way kind of thing. They're sort of like guardians, but they don't have any sort of special decisions to make about. And I think a lot of it is because they just assume that religion is not real in any way.
Right.
So that there's nothing really that they're teaching them that could be positive if they're teaching them that kind of stuff. And it's one of those things. It's like, if you believe in pluralism and diversity and all that, then it's going to be like, it's going to have some jagged edges. It's not going to just be driving through what you think kind of thing. So,
And I mean, just frankly, like you're not going to get the whole population on board with the most woke take on these things. It's just not going to happen, you know? So yeah. At some level, you sort of have to accept, like, there's going to be some part of the population that just is not going to be on board and does not want to hear their kid coming home and talking about this stuff. And it seems a little bit weird to just be like, oh, well, it doesn't matter what those people think.
Yeah.
You know?
There's something wrong there. Yeah, there's something. There's yeah, some. Yeah.
It's not a real solution, basically.
Yeah.
One good education thing I've heard about is Kelly Storette, the mobility wad guy, the functional biomechanics guy. He used his cash from being the internet's top mobility coach to switch his children's elementary school to all standing/leaning desks because sitting all day is terrible for your posture and your ability to think. So thank you, Kelly, for starting a revolution.
Yeah, I bet the kids love that.
Well,
apparently they do. I mean, they say they do because they don't have to, you know, staying still is just hard for especially boys because they just want to run around and throw rocks at each other.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, it's true for everybody. If you get to lean and wiggle around, it's less like being in a prison for your full school day.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that does make sense. It's hard to think like what that would be like, you know?
Yeah.
Being someone who just loves to sit all day now. It's
you've been trained. You've been broken by the masters. Desk. You couldn't even get out of your desk without flipping the little thing down. It was like you're belting in for a flight on a B-52 jump seat.
Oh, it's coming back to me now. Yeah, I did used to hate that stuff.
We're going to do a whole new episode about Tom's satanic ritual sitting abuse.
I got MK-Ultra'd into being lazy. All right, Leo, this one's for you. It's asking, what's up with your accent?
A lot of people ask me where I'm from. Some people ask me if I'm Norwegian. Some people ask me if I'm from Italy. I can't really tell you. I've just been around. I've been around a lot of people. Been around a lot of different races and different nationalities in my life. And my dad's from Virginia. His dad's from Alabama. And my mom's from Michigan. So I have a strange mix and it just comes out the way it does.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting you say that because I had a very similar upbringing in that way. And I think what happened to my accent is it just sort of dissolved into nothing and I don't have any kind of particular
Yes, accent. Your voice is quite neutral. You could be on NPR.
Right, yeah. yeah. But you seem to have more of like these standout things from different places where it makes it hard to place you. And I could just, you know, slip in anywhere, which makes it very useful in my line of work at the CIA, you know?
Oh, yeah. I forgot you were an asset. Yeah. Why aren't you on MSNBC if we're going to put CIA agents on TV all day?
It's a good point. Yeah, I should hit them up.
Why aren't you driving a Chevrolet Camaro in a campaign commercial for Senate saying, Tom, CIA, that means good government. Let's do it. How much money is the Patreon bringing in? We'll buy you a Camaro and film this thing.
Okay, well, it won't look like much on our Patreon, but
I always, it's funny, people will have messaged me a bit in the last few months asking me if this is my real accent. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And it to me, I have no real knowledge that I sound Canadian until people point it out, and then I go, oh, okay, I guess that's a real thing. I just have no, and then I listen to myself for like a second and I go, oh, okay, yeah, I guess there's something there. Yeah,
you sound very Canadian to me. Not like in a way where it's like cartoonishly like, oh my god, that's so Canadian, but it's just obvious that you are Canadian.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I got a message. I looked at the Reddit about Chapo the other day, and I read one of the comments was about my thing that I did the other day on there, and it said...
Outstanding, by the way. Outstanding.
It said, Do I understand what this character is supposed to be? No. Do I really enjoy hearing Felix do this voice? Yes. And I was like, okay, well, I don't know.
I don't think you sound anything like Felix.
I know. That's so why weird. I thought it was just a
wow. Wow. He's a master. He's a master of impressions. He can do them all.
Yeah.
He actually is pretty good with impressions, given how distinctive his voice, like his real voice, is.
That's true.
You'd think you'd be able to pick him out, but he's pretty good at it.
Yeah.
Okay, so next one here. I thought this would be good for us. What part of history do you find most interesting? So for me, I find the early Ottoman period pretty interesting, like the not the immediate start of the empire, but when, after, let's say, 100 years or so, that couple centuries after that, I find that really interesting.
When they're established as the Sultanate of Rum.
Like I would say basically after they take Constantinople and they really pick up speed and kind of consolidate power and become a real like world power, I find that really interesting, just given how weird of a political entity they are and how that shaped regional history and world history both. I think it's just a very interesting thing. And
what are some weird things about the Turkic takeover, like the formulation of that you enjoy?
Well, they're kind of a weird combination of almost like Mongol Turkic style, like nomad warrior stuff combined with just whatever they picked up along the way. So they have like the Byzantine things that they incorporate from when they're based in Anatolia, and then as they start to spread, they incorporate more of that, the Persian bureaucracy. I mean, not the directly the Persian bureaucracy, because I didn't take over Persia, but that culture,
that style, yeah
that was prevalent in the Middle East. And the way they use the Janissaries, I think, is really interesting. I mean, that isn't so distinctive, and I think if you look at something like the Mamluks, I think that's even more interesting in that respect. But just the fact that there was such a thing as this, like, you know, just reared from birth slave guard, is that's always kind of fascinating to me. So it's just a weird amalgamation in general of things that just really worked very well. I mean, they lasted for a very long time. They were also very like hands off in a way that, and decentralized, which made it kind of, it's just interesting to look at, like, what were they doing in this part of the world versus this part of the world? It's very different. They adapted to the local situation and kind of had a light touch to a lot of things. So
if you were writing a clickbait article, could you compare the Ottoman style to Google, where they just acquire anything that seems useful and becomes part of the machine? It keeps rolling on.
Yeah. I mean, I think actually probably the Mongol Empire would be a better one, because like massively destructive, and then even more so of just like an assimilating kind of force.
Yeah.
One thing about the Mongols that I always find endlessly amusing is that they would just collect just trinkets and treasure from all over the place where they were, you know, just conquering, and just pile it up. They would bring it back to Mongolia and just pile it up in their city. And, I mean, their city wasn't really like a city. It was like just a large encampment.
Yeah, it was, everything was on wagons. Like, they'd have these gigantic wagons that took however many 12 oxen to carry, that would be a building.
Right. And so they never really adopted like an urban culture in Mongolia itself. They kept the traditional culture. That was a really big part of the elite culture there, was just to like maintaining those old traditions. So they were not interested in developing a big palace and having all these scholars around them doing work. I mean, they did have that, but they just sort of collected them as like novelties. And then they just have piles of like stuff that they, you know, like goblets and whatever that they picked up from places, and they didn't make use of it at all. They didn't like find it like as a, it wasn't a status symbol so much, except that it was a big pile of gold that they collected, and that was the status symbol.
Yeah. You know?
So I think that's really crazy, like Mad Max kind of a thing.
And, yeah. That's funny. So Leo, how about you? What's your favorite?
I'm not going to cop out and say the Terence McKenna period before agriculture was established, when man lived in harmony with nature and built Göbekli Tepe and took mushrooms and so on, because that would be too easy. Obviously, Cain and Abel is the story of the horrible agriculturalist killing the nomadic pastoralist. We know that. We know that. But about like things where we actually have documents about and recorded history, that's a good question. There are a lot of things to choose from. You have your Louis Napoleon France, which is really similar to present day America, with the oligarchy and finance controlling things and people being miserable. It's really hard for me. I really like the African colonial era, especially the parts of Africa where Europeans couldn't win until they changed, or where Europeans actually lost a little bit. Like the Portuguese could barely penetrate into Africa until they sort of left some people there who married the locals, and they formed these little sort of semi-fortified trading towns that were all mixed race, and they would reach the Portuguese through ships traffic coming in. And stuff like Somori's empire, where he was able to fight the French for decades and actually migrated his entire country from like 1,000 kilometers to a new country just to get away from the Europeans attacking. And then you have like Congo, which was organized into this incredibly efficient slave state by Arab slave traders. There's stories of the Europeans arriving there and riding through fields of rice and grain that just went on for miles and miles, and everything was perfectly laid out in grids. I just wish we had more history from before the colonization, so we could know what was going on there, because it's really intriguing to me.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I guess for me, I mean, it's those two are more exciting than mine. Mine would probably be just World War II and after kind of thing, like post-war France, post-war Germany and all that kind of stuff. I find that stuff really interesting. I don't know, like all the sort of wave of revolutions, or like attempted revolutions and stuff, attempted insurgents, or like, you know, growth of communist parties and stuff. I don't know, I find that cool. All the like leftist train spotting stuff, like,
sure,
I'm good at, yeah, like knowing all the descendants of all the different, you know, political factions and stuff. Still, although it's funny though, because the other day I was looking at, I saw some document from some socialist group in the United States, and it had like a list of sort of small organizations in the United States that had sprung up over the last few years. And I knew almost none of them. Like, I didn't know any of them. I had no idea what their backgrounds were. I like clicked on some of them and read their about me kind of things, you know, or like statement of principles. And it was just like a complete jumble to me. It wasn't like something I could trace to any sort of hereditary, you know, group or whatever. And I think it's because I think Facebook did that. Like, I think that's what, I think a lot of these groups that exist now are just like, you know, they're like 20, 30 people that start have like a sort of master theorist who.
Yeah. Like writes, communists like a, for yeah. peace breaks off of communists for war, and they break off of communists yeah. for whale health. And yeah. it's. Each one gets more revolutionary as sure. they go on and more dogmatic.
But it's astounding to me how there's like thousands and thousands of people like that now, when like the entire left used to be like active organized membership left was like a few thousand people a few years ago kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah.
it's pretty incredible. I mean, yeah. obviously you can denigrate a lot of them as just aesthetic communists or whatever, but it's really shocking. As much as the like the far right has grown in visibility, just people being openly racist or just openly very conservative has shown up on the internet, you get the same thing with the left, but it's from nothing. It's de novo, as they say.
Yeah,
I thought for sure you were going to say Maoist China.
I mean, it's funny because I didn't even think of that. And I guess technically I went to school for that, but I don't know. Like it is something that I know. I feel I feel hesitant to feel like I know a fair amount about it compared to like the average person on the street, but I probably don't know much about it compared to like, you know, even like the average Chinese person or something, you know, like I don't know. So it's one of those things where I don't really think of it that way. I don't know. Yeah. But yeah, a lot of the math stuff, a lot of the Chinese stuff I like reading about, but I probably know more about France than China in terms of like actual like history kind of stuff though. Cause it's one of those things where anything like foreign, I find is really easy to, you know, you like you learn some of the basics, but then it's hard to actually.
Yeah, it's hard to get to the meat. It's easy to get a gloss on it, but then you can't quite figure out what was doing what.
Yeah,
yeah. I think it's really easy to make up a fantasy version of what you're reading about on that first impression, and because you don't have any real contact with it, you can't really. You don't have any real experience to like bounce that off of. And so it's just, you kind of just go on these flights of fancy and
make
up whatever you want. That's why those old primary sources are so intriguing, because you think, is this real? Is this guy telling the truth?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I did read a fair amount about like China's constitution and all stuff around that, but it's one of those things where all I can really do is just say, here are some of the logical problems at play with it or something, or like that people are debating. I can't be like, you know, I don't know anything about the actual, you know, nitty gritty sort of stuff. Like I don't know. I think that's true for a lot of things, like especially with like foreign conflicts where people sort of sketch out the logical issues at play. And the sort of terrifying thing that you learn over time is just that a lot of the time the logic is not really as apparent in reality kind of thing, you know, like people do things that are irrational all the time and contradict themselves and make mistakes.
The movements of history that don't, you can go backwards and say, oh, this correlates to drought and the economic sanctions or this encroaching neighbor, but it doesn't actually add up to that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just on the subject of military history real quick, I think it's really important not to pay attention to people who don't understand like how the military works and how combat actually works in whatever period they're talking about. Even today, like people kind of talk about different conflicts and things. And if you don't have a sense of like what the on the ground reality might look like, you end up with really weird ideas about how things are going to play out that really have nothing to do.
Could you give us an example of that sort of thinking?
I don't know. I'm not thinking of anything in specific, but just, you know, like conflicts in the Middle East right now, or when people talk about like stuff in the South China Sea or whatever the real name of that area is. I don't really know the whole politics around that, but you know, like the naval confrontations with China and the US and like, what's a realistic threat? Who has the upper hand in a given situation? Like, I feel like a lot of people throw their hat in and they don't understand at all like what the real situation is, and it ends up being this just a, you know, it just muddies the waters really fast. So I think that's true of history and for modern day stuff. Like, especially with old, like with when you look at history, people start talking about like the will of leaders and how, you know, like that had probably less to do with that than like water lines and like access to things like that, you know? So yeah, I don't know. Just throwing that out there.
You give me a lot to think about.
Okay. Well, I mean, the reason I thought of that was because you're here and I think you're someone who does know about those types of things. So whenever you're talking about like a conflict, you actually get to the nitty gritty and it cuts through a lot of the stuff that I hear floating around and I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. That makes a lot more sense than, you know, what this or that other person were saying about like these like vague abstract notions of who's in control of a situation or whatever.
Yeah. When you get into this sociology, you miss the plot for what people are just doing, even if they don't know exactly what they're doing it for. But if you know what actions they're taking, you can get to some kind of meat.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Okay, so this question seems to be for me, I think. It says, just started reading an ebook version of the Quran. On the second page, it says, the way of those on whom you have bestowed your grace, not the way of those who earned your anger, such as the Jews, nor those who went astray, such as the Christians. Damn, shots fired. What's this all about? What did the Jews do to earn such anger, and how did the Christians go astray? So this is a, I guess it's a translation of one of the lines, the opening chapter of the Quran, and this is a chapter that you recite several times in a prayer. So I think you would recite this about 17 times a day if you're doing all your five prayers. And this is like the last line. So to translate this, it would be something like, guide me to the straight path and not those who have earned your anger, or those who have gone astray. So in the Saudi-funded translation, there are a lot of interjections that come from different commentaries. And they're not unorthodox commentaries by any means, but they're definitely one individual's interpretation of the meaning of that line. And they just kind of stick it into the translation. So that's where this stuff about such as the Jews, such as the Christians comes into play here. So this commentator read that line as being like, well, the ones who've earned the anger, that's talking about the Jews. The ones who've gone astray, that's talking about the Christians. So Jews have earned anger by going back to the calf and all that kind of stuff. And Christians have gone astray by believing that, you know, Jesus was God and all this kind of stuff. So I don't think that that is exactly what that line is all about. If that is possibly part of the meaning of it, I mean, who can say? I think there's some logical validity to that, but I personally don't really read it that way. I kind of think of it in a general sense, like people who have done bad things and earned God's wrath, and people who have gone astray because of a lack of guidance or just following their own desires or whatever, something along those lines. So yeah, I would find a better translation. I think you're looking at the Sahih International translation, and maybe get a Halim translation, or the Clear Quran translation, or Muhammad Asad's translation. I would recommend all.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because wouldn't a big section of the people who the book is dictated to, however you know put it, is would be Christian Arabs, and then your pagan Arabs, they're not Jews either, but you'd think they would be part of that statement.
Yeah, there are parts of the Quran that are to, oh, you who believe. That's a very common refrain when God is talking to people, and that's kind of calling out anyone who believes himself to be a believer. It's not saying, you know, oh, you Muslims, because that wasn't really an identity at the time that the Quran was being revealed. There wasn't a sense of like, this is coming to a particular new religious identity group or anything like that. It was like, you know, all you who believe. And so if you were Christian or Jewish or whatever your particular identity was, it was just kind of like a call out to those people. So that's something that's kind of interesting to think about when you read the Quran, is to consider the fact that when it talks about Muslims, that means those who have submitted their will to God and who follow God's will and all that kind of stuff. It's not saying this particular group of people. It's talking about, and it more often uses the term believers than Muslims. I think Muslims is just used a couple times, and you who believe is used many, many, many more times. So
yeah, that's interesting. It reminds me, I started reading this book called The Catholic Priesthood: Biblical Foundations by Father Thomas Lane. And a lot of it so far has been, I mean, the whole book really is what it is it sort of shows continuities between the Old Testament and the New Testament, and sort of the issues that arose within the priesthood of the Jewish community and how that evolved over time through the Christian era. And it's actually really interesting because a lot of it is, you know, it's like talking about, you know, controversial sort of stuff that happened in the transition and all of the, you know, textual basis for things. And it's funny because so much of it really is stuff that I had no idea about, kind of thing, you know, just like totally new history to me. And then it's one of those things where it's interesting because it's in the way it's exactly like what Tom is saying, that we sort of live in this world where all of these words have already kind of been imposed on us in different ways. And so that we end up thinking that like Muslim means something like a particular religion that, and all those kind of things, you know. And one of the things that's interesting about Catholicism, almost like by definition, is that if you sort of unwind a lot of those words, it's like they're all they all point back to things that are not really super specific. They're not really supposed to be articulating something new and concrete as much as very, very general ideas about religion kind of thing or something. Now, it's different because there is a particular person, you know, the Christ that becomes like the central figure. But otherwise, and even maybe even because of that in some ways, like there's so many words and so many things about the priesthood and all those things that are really just they're the evolution of words that have root words that mean very, very general things. So I think that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's exactly the same thing in Islam.
Yeah.
You know, all kinds of the same kind of developments where like things take on this like almost technical kind of meaning. And then you read that back into the text that it was derived from.
Sure.
And that kind of has like this compounding effect where that, you know, kind of bounces back and forth, and then you get away from like the original,
sure,
perhaps intent of it. I mean, in some ways it can be clarifying perhaps, but in other ways I can also see it leading people astray, as that line is talking about.
Yeah. I think that the thing with the, that really this comes, like I see the most is when it comes to sort of attributing opinions to the church as a unit kind of thing, you know, like as a hierarchy, where in theory, like the number of things that you're supposed to attribute to the church in terms of opinions and stuff is supposed to be, it depends, right? It really depends on who you're talking to and what their intent is and what their sort of thing. Like in some cases, you know, you might want to think in terms of a very, very narrow, you know, attribution of opinions to the church kind of thing, where, you know, things like infallibility becomes a big debate where people talk about the Pope. They think that it's some sort of, it's almost like totalitarian, total truth, you know, comes from one person or something. And what it really ends up meaning, really, it's supposed to at least, is that there's sort of like a basic kernel of the faith that has its own internal logic, which you can't really go against without going against the church kind of thing, right? Like it's like, it's like an internal sort of, so that's supposed to be fairly narrow. But the problem is that obviously logical things are not, you can't isolate them. So, you know, like you might have a political opinion about something and that very quickly runs up against a church teaching, and then, you know, then you're screwed kind of thing, right? Like what, you know, what's the thing? The thing that is the problem though is then is that people cynically exploit both directions, right? They kind of say, well, you know, I'm a church official, therefore I have any opinion I have means that you should follow it kind of thing, right? And then you have the other end of it, which where you have a lot of people, it's very tendency to, there's a big tendency in the Catholic Church, especially to people to be very unorthodox and then sort of push that as sort of being like hip to the times kind of thing, you know? And then being like, well, the church itself is just like a federation almost, and we don't really have, you know, people can believe whatever they want. And I don't know if that's like a solvable contradiction, right? You just can't really, it's like just, it just exists. It's just what it is kind of thing. So, cause you don't want to be orthodox just because that's what other people believe, right? You just want to, you want to internalize it or something. So, you know.
Right. And you want to, you know, you want to subscribe to the truth of things.
Exactly.
And not just, you know, blindly take whatever institutional doctrine is just passed down because it's been passed down. You want to find the reason that that's true, you know?
Yeah. And there's also there's a very big like push to within sort of things to not represent your opinions as Catholic when the church is in deviation from you kind of thing, you know? Like, so, I mean, that, I mean, you see that constantly online. That's like a pretty standard influencer kind of thing, right? Like for Muslims and Catholics and anything where people will say, you know, oh, the Catholic view on this is not, you know, so, and then they just kind of, or like, you know, like the Muslim view is that we have no problem with abortion at any time or whatever kind of thing, you know, like they start to kind of push their thing as a representative of the faith. So I think that's a thing you got to be careful about too.
Yeah.
So
that rubs me wrong in two directions, like from a like historical perspective, like when it comes to the people doing that with like a Islamic view on things, because there's no institution like that centralizes the official opinion of the religion on a certain issue in Islam, or at least in Sunni Islam. So it doesn't make sense to talk about the Muslim view on something unless it's like really clear cut in the Quran. And there's very few things that are like that.
Yeah.
So instead, you really need to talk about what's the consensus view or what's the majoritarian view through history or what's the most widely, you know, you have to qualify it a little bit.
Yeah.
And then people just run slipshod over history and they don't really, you know, they find one guy that said one thing, they kind of twist it around to interpret it so that it agrees with what they want to say. And then they say, oh, well, this is what the Quran says now.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's not.
Yeah. Like the things that are supposed to be core truths that are like, you know, protected that you shouldn't go against openly kind of thing are stuff like Jesus rose from the dead. Like that's sort of like a basic kind of thing. But you do get people who do that in both directions then, right? They might be, they're like, oh, no, I'm Catholic, but I just believe that, you know, they might believe something that's just clearly against that or something, like say, oh, but I think it's just a parable or something. It's not really a real story and all that kind of thing. And there's no, you know, and then it's like, yeah, but, you know, in that case, you got to be, there's got to be some institutional, you know, there's got to be some sort of mechanism where you can kind of go, okay, well, you can't speak in our name in that case or something. It's hard to, but it's hard to do that without, you know, it's basically impossible to do that generally, but yeah.
So what you're saying is that we need an influencer witch finder who's finding heretics and is striking them down with a hammer.
Yeah.
Yep.
At the Inquisitor.
The Inquisitor. And you should rap as well.
Leo, did you see that they might bring mods onto the community mods onto Twitter?
No.
Yeah. They're looking at rolling out a few changes. I saw that one of them was that they might put like warning labels under misleading tweets.
I saw that. The fact checking, the Atlantic Council is going to tell us what's true and what's false.
Yeah, yeah.
They already have that. They rolled that out for a lot of school systems in America. Oh, yeah. Like the school computers have, they're already fact checking. Like you can't go to this website because the Atlantic Council says it's misleading. They're just terrified because of the somewhat open exchange of information and opinion on the internet. It doesn't go in the interest of the oligarchs who own the rest of the media, and it's really upsetting to the politicians who are you still going unchallenged. They really want to lock this shit down. And I don't know if Sanders wins, I think they'll probably be like an FBI probe, and they'll try and arrest Mark Zuckerberg unless he censors every word on Facebook.
Yeah, but I just imagine the kind of person that's going to be the Facebook mod community mod or something. I don't know. So I think that's the closest thing I have to like a 100% pure opinion is, you know, we got to get stop the rise of the age of mods. I don't know.
Yeah, we can't.
Or at least like just we got to survive it somehow.
We have to neuter them. We have to make them a laughing stock. We have to terrorize them both in person and on the internet.
I mean, I think it could set up some pretty funny joke setups. Like if it ends up being that even if you're a relatively small account, if you say something that's not factual, they'll give you a little like fact check thing. It would be kind of funny to say something really ridiculous and then have some nerd come by and be like, actually, this isn't true. I don't know.
Yeah, I get that. Like if sometimes I make a tweet and it's just a straight up joke that uses, say, real situation as a background. And once enough people have retweeted it, you get those people who are like, actually, that's incorrect. Like, what the fuck, dude? What's a joke? Yeah. What's a joke?
Yeah. Yep. I am a little bit worried about females cannot read movement being. But I'm going to try and pull some strings and see if they will see the light on this one and come to the truth.
Well, if Bernie wins, I think we know that, like, you know, we're taken care of.
He's our guy. He's gonna make sure that whole ruse comes to an end.
Yeah.
All right, Donald. I got a question for you. Why should I watch the Josie and the Pussycats movie?
So, this movie came out in I believe 2001, and it's just one of those things where it was like, here's what's gonna happen over the next 20 years, basically, and it was right. And it has some good people in it, like Parker Posey and Alan Cumming and stuff, and they're pretty funny in it, and it's just goofy and fun, and this music is pretty good. And it was one of those movies where I could, like, I memorized it basically. And I don't know, I think it's pretty good. And so the general plot of it is this idea that it's about big companies trying to cash in on old brands and all that kind of stuff, or like small bands and small things. And it's just very, very corny and cheesy. And it's about how the media is controlled by like a central organization to promote like the military and all this kind of stuff. And I don't know, it's just very, very corny. And like, it's funny knowing what happened afterwards with like all the Marvel stuff and everything. I don't know, it's pretty good. I promoted it. I saw it a bunch of times in theater. I got a lot of posters for it and stuff. So yeah, I live the dream.
It's a good movie. It's like if you've watched Spice World and you enjoy the absurdity, but you want a little bit more political commentary in the subtext of your girl singer movie, Josie and the Pussycats, watch it.
Yeah, and I also thought
$3.99 Amazon.com. I get 4 cents if you buy that.
Yeah, I also thought the Rachel A. Cook was a very good looking in it. So when I was younger,
she was a beauty.
So
what's happened to her today? That's the question.
I kind of get like a My Little Pony type of vibe from, like,
yep.
Oh, just yep. Okay. Well, kind of vibe. Like it's seems like it's created for like little girls, and I don't want to really be watching something for little girls. Like, you know what I mean? Like it would feel a little bit strange.
Yeah. It's not really, I mean, it is, but it's basically what they did is they took a comic book property and drove it into the ground. And it's got like Seth Green is in it, I think. And yes. And they've got like a stupid point. It's extremely stupid. That's the key part of it. And it's making fun of teen movies a lot of it. So I don't know. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm still probably not going to see that.
No.
I've always been more of a, what's his name? Jamie Kennedy guy.
Oh. Yeah, Seth Green guy. Oh God. Seth, how about Seth Green having a television show called Robot Chicken that's still airing new seasons up to this day?
They're still making that show?
Yes.
Holy. Wow. I had no idea.
I believe that there's a interview or something somewhere where Werner Herzog talks about the cartoons he likes, and then he goes out of his way to mention how much he hates Robot Chicken.
good man. All right. Can you please give your complete thoughts on Barack Obama? I can't. I will get canceled up and down, but let's just say that I wish he was a secret communist Muslim. That's kind of how I feel about it.
That would have been fantastic if he had been a communist Muslim. Instead, he gave, what's the total figure when they calculated? Is it 600 trillion, 60 trillion to American and global banks? And then he said it was just too much to give money to people who were facing foreclosure. And he oversaw the largest reduction in black wealth in history, like 50% of household wealth in African American community disappeared thanks to the financial crash, and Obama did nothing to help them. And he, you know, he kept the big tech mergers going. Basically just awful. As awful as you can be.
Right.
He just made, you know, he made America the plutocracy. It is, he solidified that after the, you know, the creation and with Paul Volcker and Jimmy Carter administration and Michael Milken financing corporate raiders and all that. But Barack Obama just, he put the tiara on the princess economy.
Yeah. And I feel like if you hate Trump, you have to hate Obama, because
the reason absolutely.
We have Trump with the power that he does have is because Obama paved the way. And essentially all the real difference between them is just like a marketing veneer, you know, like we got mm-hmm. Obama with the corporate smiley face, kind of liberal values thing. And then we got Trump coming in because that went out of favor. So, and then we got this more like, I'm the radical, cool and edgy kind of like conservative type. So,
yeah. And I mean, it's worth remembering that when people are celebrating Obama is that he didn't want to legalize gay marriage until Joe Biden accidentally said something about it on TV, on live TV.
Yeah. And marijuana too. He was against that the whole
time. Yeah. He is. Obama's not your friend.
I think that Libya is also a thing that doesn't get talked about as much as it probably should, you know, and all those different things that had happened in foreign policy where, you know, I mean, I'm sure it could have been worse if McCain was in or something, but like, it got pretty bad on a lot of things, but there wasn't like the same level of like American troops involved. So people sort of gave it a pass. But yeah. Not only gave it a pass, but progressives gave it a pass, like a lot of them. Like, I think, you know, Bernie was probably pretty good on it, but like Elizabeth Warren at the time was like, said that it was like an almost, and so did like Keith Ellison and all these people, like said that it was almost like an ideal operation of like a showing Americans cooperating and using foreign policy and, you know, like diplomacy and in military things in a right way. And yeah, that I think in retrospect that's probably a bad sign to me that like even the left broader, you know, like the middle of the left wing was on board for a lot of that stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of Ellison, you know, people kind of like to point to him as like, oh, he's like a Muslim leftist guy. Like he sucks. I really don't like him.
Oh, really?
He's left of, you know, he's on the left wing of the Democrats. Sure. But he has not been helpful in promoting any kind of like, good policies around, you know, our United States involvement with like Muslim communities abroad. I don't really like to think of him as some kind of like representative of Muslims or something, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's do this one. Does being right about anything actually matter? Seems like it's hard to be definitively right about anything. Isn't it more useful to construct a mental complex of ideas and concepts allowing you to pursue successful actions?
I don't know what the difference is, really. I don't know. I feel like being right. True. Yeah, I don't know. I guess it matters if you think that, if you want to help people and, you know, be positive in their lives and find ways of solving big problems and all that kind of stuff. Like, I mean, it's one of those things where, like, if you don't have goals, then yeah, you don't need opinions about things. You know what I mean? Like, you don't, doesn't really matter then, right? Like, if you, so the goals sort of are determined by moral principles, I guess. And then how you solve them are also determined by that.
Mm-hmm. I feel like this question seems to come from like a consideration of religion as good, even if it's not true, sort of a thing.
Okay.
Do you get that feeling from it, maybe?
I don't know. I don't know.
It seems like it's more about having a philosophical framework, the way, say, you're really into Aristotle and you read the various moral philosophies and you take that, or say, you, combining the sort of moral philosophy with something more more involved like Hegel, and you can view the world through that lens and it helps you filter things out. And so rather than just knowing this is true without anything linking them, I'm not exactly sure what they're trying to get at.
Yeah.
I sort of feel like as a human being, you can't fully grasp the truth anyways. So it's sort of like you can know that some things perhaps are true in a way that you can't fully understand. It's sort of a lost cause to really try to, like, you know, that you really want to fully, like, I won't act until I fully know the truth kind of a thing. Sure. You know?
Yeah. It's a bad infinity. You can never get all the way down. It's just going to keep splitting.
Yeah. So like you can know there's good, there's evil. I should be good. I should not be evil, and find a way to help you determine what's the difference. You know, I think that's all you can really do.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Okay, let's do one more. Okay. Hey, Tom, you were wrong in the last podcast. Siege isn't a novel or fiction. It currently is a collection of editorial writings of James Mason in the Siege newsletter. And since it is organized chronologically, it goes from doubtful of Mason's critical phase of the movementarianism dominant of in the white movement after Rockwell's death, to his magnificent and truly revolutionary National Socialist armed struggle and lone wolf phase. You fucks should respect more your white nationalist listeners. No, that was really painful to read. That was a big run-on sentence. So if you're like all about, you know, promoting Western civilization, you should learn how to write.
You want to know a little trivia? My dad went down the road where I believe his name is George Lincoln Rockwell, the American Nazi Party president, was assassinated. He was down just down the street after they shot him. I'm not saying he did it, but just saying.
He was sending good vibes, maybe. When
yeah, my dad loves to vibe out.
Yeah. So, just a warning to any of us, any of those listeners that, you know, are white nationalists, that
be careful. Yeah. I mean, I understand that you want to have your own identity for grievance, but I feel like Western civilization's accomplished cooler things to focus on than just. Continuing like an Anglo birthright. If anything, you want to continue the Dutch birthright because they're very attractive.
I agree.
Yeah. And yeah, so white nationalists, you can go fuck off, but also DM me and we'll talk after the podcast.
Hash it out. I feel like we can all, I feel like Islam and white nationalism could fit together because of the, if you go back into the Arab chauvinistic parts of the caliphate, you could say, see, we can be chauvinistic, but we don't have to be.
I mean, that was really cool. I see what you're saying. And there are some people who do try to run with that on Twitter. There's a few people who talk about like the Northern Wilayette and all this kind of stuff and the need for like Asabiya among white people and all this kind of stuff, forming a tribe and all that. But there's really like fundamentally like anti-racist stuff that the prophet said, like in his farewell speech, he specifically said that a white man is not better than a black man and a black man is not better than a white man, except for in piety. So
the caliphs weren't really following the book, which you can say the same thing about Roman emperors not really following.
Well, let's be clear though, we're talking about the Umayyads, not the immediate successors.
The Umayyads were a bunch of assholes.
Yeah, pretty much. They kind of just brought back like an Arab kingship, which is exactly what the prophet said would happen.
I see an Umayyad, I see that's either a geezer, a skeezer, or a weirdo.
Perverts and losers, as I like to say.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right, well, I think that could wrap it up here for this episode. Thanks for coming on, Leo.
Sure. It was a pleasure to be on. You guys have a wonderful show. I hope.
Hello? Okay. thanks, Leo. So thanks for listening, guys. If you enjoyed the show, second episode every week, you can subscribe to our Patreon and you'll get that. You'll also get access to our Discord, where you can chat with us in our community. And yeah, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next week.
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
Whenever I get dressed up, I feel like an ex-con trying to make. Jacket and tie, feel like such a lie. When I go to your house, I feel like I'm casing the joints. In the grocery store, in line, behind a mother and child, take that child. take that child. Out on the streets, I feel like a robot by the